My name's Andy. I usually play piano up here. I'm 33. My wife Elaine and I are going to celebrate our 10th anniversary in a few days, end of May. And you guys think I don't know my anniversary? Is that what you're thinking? That's fun. Best part for me is that my anniversary is on May 28th, and then Elaine's birthday is on June 10th. So it's a particularly challenging time for me in general. We planned poorly is what I'm saying. So I'm married. I work downtown in Buckhead at a startup company called SalesLoft, where I do, I'm an engineer in the support department, and I'm an elder at this church. So that's where this is at. We do a Bible study, Elaine and I do, at our house every Thursday, and we've been doing this for years now. And it started out as a Bible study that we wanted to have for, I don't actually know that we had plans, but either way, we were thinking, you know, people our age. And what we ended up with was people who are 21 on average. And so Zach jokes that we have the college ministry at our house every Thursday. And so it's kind of a neat thing because most of the people that go to that study don't live near us because we live downtown Grant Park, kind of near Turner Field. And so it's kind of a trek for a lot of people who live out here to go there. And so it's kind of this neat barrier that was put in place, I suppose, by God. Such that man, 21-year-olds have to, now they get free food if they come. We cook dinner actually now, since my hours have gotten a lot longer, Creighton cooks food every week. And so it's kind of a cool thing that we've been doing for a while, and we've gone through a lot of books, Luke, Acts. Jeez, man, we're still in Acts, aren't we? Boy, it sure takes us a long time to go through books. So we've done Luke and Acts and Revelation, Jeremiah, Job, Ephesians, Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, and now we're in Numbers. Song of Solomon. We did Song of Solomon, which was a joke because most of the people were married. We did it anyway. So we're in Numbers, and this was not really a concerted effort on our part to be planned. It was more kind of we did Exodus, and then after that is Leviticus, and that's kind of more of the story. And so we did Leviticus thinking, like, we're going to do that, and then certainly we're going to move on because the law is very boring. Then it turned out the law was not so boring, so now we're doing Numbers and fighting hard through Numbers. Numbers is very... God kills a lot of people in Numbers is what I found out. He kills a great deal of people, and that there are a lot of fun at the end. Leviticus, you got slavery. That's fun. So that's kind of the way that we roll. So we have young people, and the young people that I found, the way that it works is that the younger generation seems to be very, 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 very concerned with truth. And so that's kind of what the Bible study is all about. That's the way that we've been doing it, and that we're going to be fair in the interpretations. We're going to prove that what we're saying is true. In other words, when we talk about a subject and we're saying like, hey, so-and-so said this, I mean, they really need to have said that. It needs to be a reasonable interpretation because that's what we've learned. It's important to people. So that said, the question for me was like, what are we going to talk about today when Zach asked that I would teach? And the answer for me, I guess, is I was thinking, well, we should just do what we normally do every Thursday because it's simple and it seems fine. The problem, though, is that a lot of people go to the study who are currently here. And so it seems unfair if we were to do a topic that we've already kind of done before, or if we were to do a passage that we've already done. And then it would also be weird to have to do next week's study on a Sunday. So anyway, so it got complicated, and I figured, okay, so maybe we can talk about some of the things, because there are always topics when you're going through something like Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, whatever. Like, you go over that much time or that many themes. And there are always some things that if I had to go back and do it again, there's some things that I wish I could talk about more, given what we ended up learning later on, that these things are these big, broad patterns that God draws. In other words, you can go through a few chapters at a time, or you can go through a few verses at a time, and you can learn some things. It's kind of like the Bible is like concentrated orange juice, and you add water to it, and then you get something you can drink, as opposed to, you know, you try to take too much of it at once. It's difficult. So we generally do a couple chapters in our study, but that means that we're glossing over a whole bunch of things just by necessity. And some of the topics that I found to be important in retrospect that we didn't talk about at the time that we were studying them, things like the Sabbath. That's a fascinating concept to me, given that it's in the Ten Commandments. That means that God takes it seriously. God kicked Israel out of the Promised Land over Sabbath year violations. God seems to take that so seriously. That seems to be in the Bible. And it seems that our culture seems to have a whole misconception about that particular topic, in that we think that, oh, the Sabbath means that's the day that you have to go to church. It's not really presented that way. It's presented as, well, God had to rest after 6 days, so maybe you should too. That's pretty much it. In other words, when they're saying, when Jesus is healing somebody on the Sabbath, and they're saying, how don't you know you're not supposed to work on the Sabbath? And Jesus' response is, do you really think that man was created for the Sabbath? Do you think the Sabbath was created for man? He's saying, like, this is the whole point, this is a benefit to you. And it's nice. And so my wife and I started practicing recently this idea of, okay, so on Saturdays, we're going to do literally nothing. And when I say nothing, I mean like Old Testament style, you don't light a fire, nothing. Basically, the way that it works in my mind is like, because we're all spirit of the law, new covenant and such. So the way that it works for me is if I feel like it's work, I'm not doing it. I don't have to. I don't have to do it because the Bible says I don't have to do it. See, Elaine and we see work as different things. See, Elaine is like, hey, let's pick up the bedroom, and then in the process, let's organize these things. And it occurred to me about 9 years into marriage that she's getting something different out of that than I am, that this is full-on work for me. And for her, it's like, we're making things in order, and this is so great. This is nice. And I feel like that's unfair. I'm just going to do this in front of it. So anyway, so Sabbath is a very important thing. It means that you can't even think about work. And that's more resting than I think not even doing work in the first place. Like, it's one thing to not mow the lawn. It's a whole other thing to think it's okay to not mow the lawn, to not have the stress. So Sabbaths are interesting to me, and God takes it really seriously. And he talk a lot about it. And yet that's something that's not that interesting in our culture. Same thing with parents. I mean, put honor your father and mother in the Ten Commandments, which means that apparently should be important to us. That is very much not important to us in our culture. Our parents are a burden at some point, right? Yeah, no, I got it. Yeah, we're on totally different pages, I'm sure, because you all are really excited to talk to your parents. You ever try to talk to your grandmother when she's 80 years old? There's a stand-up comedian that I really like. There's a stand-up comedian I like a lot who kind of makes the point. He talks about that old people say really racist things sometimes, and then his response to that is, well, what exactly were you expecting they would say? Like, really? Like, all you know where they came from. Like, all this stuff. But why? Yeah, they're going to say some. And that blows your mind. And so it kind of creates this barrier. Like, I have no relating points with you. Even though, like, I have grandparents who are actually really fascinating that they would, you know, my grandfather was in World War II, in the Korean War. He was shot down, POW. Like, whole deal. My grandmother, my mom grew up a majority of her time in Japan because the base was there and so on and so forth. Like, there's all this neat history and stuff that only now am I caring about, but I promise you this, the only reason I care about it is because I'm thinking back and I'm like, man, God really makes a big deal about this whole parent thing. Honor your father and mother, like this ancestor stuff. And then I look at something like with, Elaine works with a lot of Asian area people at the work that she's at Home Depot online. It's a internet thing, so yeah, Asians. And so you have, that's culturalist, not racist, by the way. It's a very specific thing. Indians and Koreans, the fascinating thing about their cultures is that they take how you respect your elders and your ancestors very, 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 very seriously, to the point where there was a Korean, the Korean friend of hers who, he said his parents were going to convert to Catholicism and that this was a good thing or whatever. And the reason that they were going to convert to Catholicism is because, as they were saying, Catholicism allows for ancestor worship. And that blew my mind in like five ways. Because, no, it doesn't. I mean, Catholicism does some weird things, but it doesn't allow for ancestor worship. And furthermore, why is this important to you? Why is that the line that you're drawing? That, I'll switch religions as long as I can worship my grandparents. I have never felt that temptation in my whole life. But yeah, God makes a big deal about things like that. And so every now and then I kind of look around and I think, like, man, maybe some other people, even if they're doing it wrong, maybe some other people understand some things that we don't. So anyway, those aren't the topics that we're actually going to do today, but the one we are going to do is kind of along those lines. Oh yeah, we do this, by the way. There's a lot of movement in some of this teaching. Brace yourself. So what we're going to do, we're going to talk about the firstborn situation, which is something else we don't do. Not that, I want to be clear, we're not going toward like, you need to give twice your inheritance to your firstborn. That's not the point. That's not where we're going. Although, I mean, it talks about it a lot. So God talks a lot about the firstborns. And I think that the firstborns is kind of along the lines of slavery in the same vein, in that God talks about it a lot, but it doesn't necessarily mean that what he is doing is saying that this is a good thing and then therefore we should emulate it. What he's doing instead is saying that this is something that is a mainstay of cultures. And so therefore you have a reference point to understand the points that he's making. In other words, just because he says that we were all slaves and now we are bondservants, which means voluntary slave, essentially, doesn't mean that he's all big on slavery. In fact, he's not big on slavery, which is why he's presenting himself as the one who frees people from slavery. But nevertheless, he still references it a lot because we can understand that slavery kind of sucks. And so if slavery is bad and we don't want to be it, and he says that you are slaves, then we understand, okay, I get it, that this is something that I am beholden to and I can't do anything about that. And Jesus is the one who's going to allow me to not be that. He's going to set me free. And then me appreciating them, me finding that, oh, wow, I actually would rather serve you than have my own freedom, that I'm going to attach myself to you, and then I become a bondservant. We understand that because we've seen slaves, because we've at least read about slaves, hopefully. Hopefully we're not seeing slaves, I mean, now. But some of us are slaves. It's metaphor. So anyway, the point is, this firstborn thing, I think, is similar. I don't think that God is necessarily saying, like, hey, you should elevate one of your children just because they were born first or whatever, but they did a lot, and they still do in other cultures. So, I mean, because Jesus was a firstborn and God said that was really important because you should always care about one of your children more than the others. I don't have children. I don't know if that's true. I just assume because I've only ever read the Bible and I have no children. So I assume we do love our children unequally. Is that how that works? No? Psychology Today, which is ever reliable, told me no, we should not do that. Today, I'll tell you how seriously Jesus takes this, or how seriously God takes this. These are passages referring to Jesus as the firstborn. This is Romans 8. He says, and we know that all things work together for good to those who love God. We all know this. This is a favorite verse, but it follows with, to those who are called according to his purpose. So we have some fun predestination in there. And then it follows with, for whom he foreknew, he also predestined to be conformed to the image of his son, that he, his son, might be the firstborn among many brethren. In other words, he's concluding this passage by using this firstborn idea to say, like, see, Jesus is super special to the extent that he is the one who inherits, right? So the idea of firstborn in the Bible kind of comes down a lot to this idea of inheritance, meaning that the Father, you are the one of glory, and so your inheritance goes, that your name goes through this person, and so on. Colossians 1, Paul says, he is the image, he being Jesus, of the invisible God, the firstborn over all creation, for by him all things were created that are in heaven and that are on earth, visible and invisible, whether thrones or dominions or principalities or powers, all things were created through him and for him, and he is before all things. And in him, all things consist. And he is the head of the body, the church, who is the beginning, the firstborn from the dead, that in all things he may have the preeminence. So we know that firstborn, this idea in practice, is real rough on kids. All the studies that I read, generally, I mean, I would show them to you, except that they're all consistent. It's like, look, if you elevate one child over the rest of the children, all of them suffer bad consequences. In a lot of ways, we're like, well, of course these guys are, and they're going to fight. Like, it basically just creates this fun little, like, Thunderdome sort of competitiveness between children so that everybody loses except the one who gets the inheritance, but then he's angry anyway. And so it's bad, right? In practice it's bad, but at the same time, this idea that God accepts that cultures through the ages, through thousands and thousands of years, have emphasized this idea of firstborn and inheritance and glory going to one person over the others. God takes advantage of this natural disposition of humans and then use it. So the important part about this is that if God is saying that this firstborn idea is important, if he is bestowing upon Jesus honor by calling him the firstborn, then that means that he is seeing this as a method of explanation. In other words, he's saying, I am going to explain to you that Jesus has these beautiful, fantastic, ancestral roots to David. That's important. The Messiah, him being the Messiah, you trace his ancestry to David. And the way that it introduces it in Matthew, when you're going through those boring genealogies that nobody reads, it introduces Jesus as a son of Abraham, and then it goes Abraham, and then it goes all the way down the line through David to show that he has the messianic ancestral line. This was important. This is the first thing that was written in Matthew, which is a gospel for both the Jews and the, in other words, if he's proving via prophecy that Jesus was who he said he was, the first thing he starts out with is, boom, genealogy, so that you know. Because to them, to the people who were reading this, the Jews, that ancestral line was very important because it goes along with the prophecy. And it's true, when you go through the prophecy, and there's a lot of it in the Old Testament talking about the lineage of Jesus, talking about the lineage of what the Messiah was going to be, they all knew he was going to come from David. So showing that, and showing that it goes all the way back to Abraham and how that goes, then we know that Jesus is who he says he is. But here's the thing. You know that ancestral lineage in this culture goes through the firstborn. The name goes to the firstborn. To the extent that in the law, if because of the way that things were, and this gets weird, just flow. If you married somebody and then you died, it was your brother's responsibility to then marry your wife and have a child. But that firstborn child, the firstborn boy, because this gets worse, the firstborn male takes on his brother's name, meaning the one who died. In other words, you as a brother, you I don't have a brother, but I can only imagine this would be weird, where I marry, and I'm the firstborn, I marry someone, my brother then marries my wife and then has a child, and that first child is named after me, the dead one, to carry on my line, because I'm the firstborn. Like, talk about rubbing it into a brother, man. Like, not only are you not getting the inheritance, your first child, not even yours, named after your brother who always had everything. You see how this creates tension with people? So here's the thing. So it's always going through firstborn, and in the law, it even builds up this idea. It says if you have two wives, because why wouldn't you? If you have two wives, and again, Bible's not pushing for this. It's very clear. There's a lot of good examples of why having two wives or 10 wives, David, or 1,000 wives, Solomon, is a really, really, really bad idea. Either way, though, should you find yourself with two wives and you love one and you don't love the other because you make mistakes, you love one wife, you don't love the other wife, you have them, and both of them have firstborn sons. But the unloved wife, her son came first. That's your firstborn. And it says, I kid you not, in Numbers, we haven't got there, guys, yet, Bible study people. It says in Numbers, you cannot favor the firstborn son of your loved wife if the firstborn son of the unloved wife came first. You must give him a double portion of your inheritance. Serious stuff, guys. The point, though, is that there are regulations in the law about the firstborn, meaning God is not playing around with this concept. And so we know that this is important. We know that it is used to then bestow glory upon Jesus. And yet, here's the part that I can't get over. We've known, or at least if we look back, then we can use theology and we can use education to figure out that, okay, part of that promise that he gave to Adam and Eve when they were cursed, part of that promise, the one that he gave to Eve, is referring to this messianic lineage that was going to begin then. And so the messianic lineage was going to go through people, and then it was going to go through the firstborns, because this is just something that is taken for granted in the old life. Of course it's going to go through the firstborns. Of course it is. Here's the deal. Who was Adam's firstborn? Cain. It didn't go through Cain. It went through Seth, the thirdborn, right? Abraham's firstborn was Ishmael. Didn't go through Ishmael, went through Isaac. Isaac's firstborn was. Yeah, we can do this. Come on, let's call in response. We can be Baptist for a day. Let's do this. Isaac's firstborn was Esau, the hairy one. Esau was so hairy that Jacob put on an animal's skin. He put on fur. He put on a literal fur. And his father was like, because his father's blind at this point, Isaac's like, Esau. These are fun things you find out when you go through the Old Testament. It's good stuff back there. So his firstborn's Esau, and this is that famous thing where Jacob's like, remember the, so Jacob's like, okay, so I gotta get this birthright. Now, the fascinating thing about that is, why in the world does Jacob care about this birthright? Like, what comes with it? The inheritance? What is the inheritance to them? See, what you have to conclude is that Abraham was given this promise, right? And so Isaac certainly knows this promise. Why? Because when Abraham was going to get Isaac's wife, he was like, do not take a wife from Canaan, he says to a servant who represents the Holy Spirit. It's another Bible study. So the whole servant goes back to Babylon-ish, wherever they, it goes back to Ur. And in Ur is like, look at, and he finds the wife, and she agrees to go. It's a beautiful story. She comes back. So anyways, like, Abraham made a huge deal out of like who Isaac was going to marry, where all of this was going to come from, because Isaac was the child of promise. And so Isaac knows this, and Isaac has apparently told this to his children. This becomes a running theme with the patriarchs, that this will be somehow passed down. It never tells us that it was passed down, but it had to be, because so much of their life significantly was impacted by this promise that they were supposed to have. They were going to be the people, right? And so Isaac is going to bestow, and Esau could not possibly have cared less. And we know this because Esau was like, I will take soup over my birthright. Soup today sounds fantastic. Have my birthright, I don't care. Because it doesn't make any difference. Why? Because Esau could hunt. He was self-sufficient. And Jacob was unloved by his father because his father loved the firstborn. So Jacob wanted to be the firstborn. Now, all of that makes Jacob sound both like a kind of a criminal and also kind of like, yeah, but he really loved God. That wasn't true. What happened was is that Jacob, I'm serious, Jacob went then, he's running from Esau because Esau, the hunter, fur guy, wanted to kill him. And so Jacob's running from him, and Jacob gets to this point. This is where you get that whole Jacob's ladder deal. Jacob falls asleep, has a vision. And God says some fascinating stuff to Jacob, including like, hey, Jacob, not really acknowledging that Jacob had tried to take the birthright. He goes, hey, Jacob, so I'm going to make a nation through you. You're the inheritor of the promise. I will be with you. And most importantly, he says to him, and no matter what, I will always protect you. Right? This is the good news that Jacob would then embrace, of course, because his entire purpose in being where he was he was running from Esau. Except that he didn't. The way that Jacob responds to him is he says, okay, surely God is here. I didn't know that. He answers to God, if you will do these things, then you will be my God. Because that's how that works. We'll see. We'll see how it ends up. Yeah, you make me a nation of millions. And then, right? And Jacob, now here's the thing. We know from Hebrews that Jacob was just. So we at least have that, right? But it doesn't go back. It's interesting when you look through Hebrews and it's going through some of those famous people and it's saying like why they were considered faithful. And Jacob's not supposed to be considered faithful because he stole the birthright. Jacob was faithful because at the very end of his life, he did this blessing thing that we're going to talk about in a second. But in the meantime, Jacob was not a great guy. And the thing is that, man, you go through Jacob may be the most fascinating person in the whole Bible because Jacob's definitely a Christian, as we would. Jacob's a chosen person, sure, called, chosen, run. And he goes through his life, and in spite of the fact that it's like, if we were really just going to boil all this down, which is the way that our culture likes to do it, into like, is Jacob going to heaven? Sure is. Great. But at the end of it, you know, when he's in front of Pharaoh, after all this time, because Pharaoh has met Joseph, and Pharaoh's been hanging out with Joseph. Joseph's this great guy. Pharaoh loves Joseph. And he's like, oh my gosh, I can't wait to meet your father. Honor your father and mother. So he's going to meet his father, and this is a big deal to him. And in comes Jacob, who has to be carried on a cart to Egypt. And he gets there, and Pharaoh gives him this, the tone of it is fascinating. Pharaoh's like, he's like, Jacob, this is the most powerful person in the universe asking this to Jacob. Jacob, how are things? And Jacob goes, my life has been full of trouble and my years have been shorter than my forefathers. And then it follows with, and then Jacob blessed him and went on his way. Jacob, the guy who has had his horrible life, blesses Pharaoh after saying, like, you know what? My life has been kind of bad, right? The point being that it's not this stealing of the birthright that made Jacob righteous. Jacob was righteous because what happened in his lifetime at the end, when he's blind, he's dying, and he's going to do this promise thing, the same kind of promise thing that Isaac had done for him and Esau. Less so Esau. The faithful thing that is accounted to him is that all of his children are brought to him, right? And his children are like 80 years old at this point. There's a weird age thing in the Old Testament that's also there. But either way, these are dudes at this point. Like, these are men that are coming before the God to be blessed, right? Now, here's the thing. What we know is that at some point, Reuben, his firstborn of 12, Reuben slept with his concubine. That is a whole other thing, all right? He had a concubine. That's fine. So, whatever. Just too many weird things in the Old Testament. Reuben slept with him. You can only imagine that if we were going to get past the concubine issue for just a second, that if you had a concubine and your oldest son slept with your concubine, it's disrespect. It's a high level of disrespect, right? We all can get that, right? Like, even if we're not on the concubine train, fine. So, and we're not on the concubine train. I'm going to be super clear because this is being taped. We're not on the concubine train or the slavery train or any of the other fun things that God brings up. So Reuben has greatly disrespected his father. We also know that Reuben is a coward because you remember that it took the 12 brothers, 11 of 10 brothers, they kill Joseph, right? Well, at least they think that they killed Joseph. They take Joseph. They hate Joseph. They put Joseph in a pit. They are then discussing what they should do with Joseph. And Reuben's like, guys, I don't know. Reuben the firstborn, I don't know. And I think it's Judah who ends up saying, like, why don't we just sell him for slavery? We can make a quick buck. He's going to go to Egypt. Life will be sad to their brother because, you know, firstborn. And so Joseph gets sold into slavery. We all know how that goes. And Joseph rises to whatever. Joseph is a messianic metaphor, right? He's a type. He's an archetype. So anyway, Joseph being that he is, what ends up happening is Joseph is not going to be an inheritor in the way that this is thematic. And so Joseph has two sons. And the way that Jacob works it out is Jacob replaces Joseph's inheritance with the two sons. And so here's what happens in this big blessing at the end of Genesis. Jacob brings them all in. Jacob replaces Reuben with Joseph, but not just Joseph. He replaces Reuben with Joseph's two sons in birth order. So Joseph's two sons are Manasseh and Ephraim. Manasseh is the firstborn. Ephraim is the secondborn. And so he brings them over, and Jacob's all blind. He's like, puts his hands down. And then Joseph, I say this because of Joseph's reaction, okay? Not because I'm judging the guy because he's old. But he does, because and Joseph goes, no, your right hand is on the wrong guy. Manasseh is my firstborn, and Joseph's like, I know what I'm doing, and then reverses him. So Jacob reverses his own son's birth order, puts Joseph first, reverses the sons of Joseph, puts Ephraim first, and God reverses all of it and puts Judah first. Because at this point, if we're following the pattern, since Abraham, firstborn means nothing, apparently. So Judah's the firstborn. This is what 1 Chronicles 5 says as an explanation to all the stuff that we just talked about. It says, now the sons of Reuben, the firstborn of Israel. He was indeed the firstborn, but because he defiled his father's bed, his birthright was given to the sons of Joseph, the son of Israel, so that the genealogy is not listed according to the birthright. Yet Judah prevailed over his brothers, and from him came a ruler, although the birthright was Joseph's. Now, before you think that the point of this study is that we're getting to, like, you need to overcome your brothers, let's talk about Judah. So Judah had three sons, Onan, and Shelah. Recognize any of them? No, you do not. Here's why. So was given a wife. Her name was Tamar. So Judah gives his firstborn son, a wife named Tamar. And she was, not she, was bad. We don't have an explanation, but he was bad enough that God was like, nope, and just killed him. That is literally how it explains in the Bible. No. He was wicked, and so God killed him. Next verse. So naturally, Onan is supposed to marry, like we talked about before, he's supposed to marry Tamar and produce an heir for his brother. And Onan takes advantage of the situation and does not produce an heir. You can read about that on your own time. 3, God kills Onan is where this ends. Finally, you have Shelah. Shelah is just a wee lad. So Shelah, not being of marrying age, is promised by Judah that that Tamar will be given to him. And Tamar is like, yay. Because she gets to marry a boy, I guess. Nothing about this is fun for Tamar, is what I get. Keep in mind also that Tamar is a Gentile, not from the, Tamar's a Canaanite. That's off book. That is not okay. That's never okay, yet. Yeah, she is. So Tamar is a Canaanite, and she's got this little boy future husband. And so she goes back and lives with her parents, which I'm sure is excruciating. And then as he grows up, he becomes the age that he can marry, and Judah's like, nah. And Tamar takes things in her own hands. And by that I mean she dresses up like a prostitute, because Judah's a stand-up guy. And so she goes to wherever they're supposed to be, where she knows Judah will be, dresses like prostitute, disguises herself. Judah's like, all right, and then sleeps with her. In sleeping with her, he promises her a goat, because Old Testament. And he doesn't have the goat. And she's like, well, I need a surety. And so he gives her a staff and a signet, again, because these are things they had. This proved him, it's one of a kind, whatever. So, and then he goes off, and then he comes back to give her the goat, she's gone. And they're like, we don't know, there was never a prostitute here. And they're, okay. So then eventually what happens is they say to Judah, because Tamar gets pregnant. Did I mention that? Tamar gets pregnant from her father-in-law. Fine. So they say to Judah, your daughter-in-law is a harlot. She's pregnant. And Judah becomes self-righteous and goes, not so, and says, let's bring her out and we will burn her. The person that you have routinely messed up. Like, if you ever step back and you think about some of the things that these are going, like, you really accept that this stuff is actually happening, that this happened to people, is some of this stuff is cruel and just amazingly, amazingly difficult to process. Judah did these things. It says, okay, the result is you've disrespected me, so you should be burned. They bring her out, and she's like, hey, look, I have this staff and this signet that you gave me. Aren't these yours? He goes, how did you? Oh, no. Judah was the one who overcame his brothers. Judah had 2 children. They were twins with Tamar. And so not only is the firstborn, or any of the 3, not the people who carry the inheritance and the promise, but rather, you have Zerah and Perez. These are the names of the twins that Tamar was giving birth to. And then there's this really fun part of the Bible where it talks about, like, so she's giving birth, and one of the guys goes, argh! And they're like, oh, firstborn, tie a scarlet string around his wrist, so that we'll know. And then he goes, nah. And then Perez breaks through. That was Zerah. Zerah gets the string, Perez breaks through. And that's why his name is Perez. It means breach. Lineage goes through Perez, secondborn. You following so far? Every single one of the patriarchs was a secondborn. Not even a secondborn, later born, depending. Other famous ones, Jesse's first son, you know his name? Bet you don't. His name is Eliab. His 7th born was David. David's firstborn, Amnon. I don't even know how many children he'd had by the time he had Solomon. Solomon, the child of, the genealogy, it always refers to Solomon. It was David's son, but it was the child of Uriah's wife, Bathsheba. Not to mention the fact that we have things like Rahab, the prostitute, lineage goes through her. Ruth, the Gentile, lineage goes through her. The point is this. God made the rule of the firstborn. God designed human beings such that most cultures throughout all of history and time would follow this idea, this ideology that firstborn is the inheritor. And God went with it. And he even said, this is how you decide firstborn disputes and things like that. This is how to do the firstborn thing properly. He honors Jesus with being called the firstborn, and yet doesn't seem to adhere to these rules at all. Why? It's the same kind of idea when it comes down to when you're trying to like traverse predestination or Arminianism and things like that. And these are tricky subjects, and people argue about them too often. But either way, the way that it kind of comes down is this. If you are, this is Cliff's Notes to Predestination. If you're looking at things from God's perspective, because that's a perspective and it's true. If you're looking at things from God's perspective, predestination is easily palatable. Meaning, God can do anything. God knows everything. Did God know everything before he ever created it? Did he have a plan before he ever did any of it? Did he know that all the things that were going to happen were going to happen? Yes. Easy. And if you're uncomfortable with that, it's kind of like, sure feels like God makes a lot of mistakes for somebody who had planned. It means that they're not mistakes, and then there's wisdom in there somewhere. That's a good place to start looking, because you know that if God can't make mistakes and he's doing things that makes it look like, why'd you give him a fruit if you knew that they were going to eat it? That kind of thing. Then you should start looking there. Maybe there's like, I don't know, the meaning of life packed into that somewhere. The point being is that if you are looking at everything, the world, the universe, and everything from God's perspective, then predestination makes total sense. On the other hand, if you're looking at it from our perspective, you know, the one where we can have action points and stuff like that, stuff to do, that means Arminianism makes total sense. Why? Because it makes absolutely no difference whether or not I was predestined to do anything or not. I don't know what that is. And I know that what I end up doing, like what my life is about, who I am, what my soul is, all of that, it sure feels to me like I have a choice in all of that. Not only that, it would be totally weird and cruel, philosophically, if God was going to be like, everything is set in stone, but I need you to do all these things. And look, these are difficult philosophical concepts, and I certainly don't mean to like try and like iron them all out this morning. But at the same time, that's kind of where this stuff plays into it, because God says, look, here's an example, a tangible idea of what firstborn is. Firstborn is the inheritor, except when it's not. Is that there's actually also stuff in the law concerning firstborns. You know that you can take your child in the law, and this is fantastic. You can take your child to the elders. It has to be the mom and the dad. Mom and dad go to the elders, and they put their hand on top of the child's head, and they say, my child is a glutton and a drunk. He does nothing. He should die. And the elders go, we thought so too. And then they stone him. The important actionable words for me are glutton and drunk. That's not a child. That's a dude. That's a guy. That's like Kyle Parkin age. My child is a glutton. Larry, you following me? My child is a glutton and a drunk. So you get rid of your firstborn. Then who inherits? Next guy. So the thing about Jake is like, yeah, Jacob really loved Joseph, and he was number 11. It was just, you'd have to kill 10 of them to get Joseph to inherit the promise. But it goes along with this idea, if we're talking theology, it goes along with this idea that we as a people were grafted into the vine, meaning that we are not the people that the promise was given to. We know that. Sometimes we feel that way, like we are the people that the promise was given to. Like we buy a little hard into the whole, like, I am special. You're not. You're a Gentile. And you were a slave. But the funny thing is that Israel was born as true sons. And you go, gosh, the Old Testament is just depressing. It is depressing watching them take something that is so valuable to me. They got to see God. They got to see the smoke. They got to see Egypt destroy, all that kind of stuff. And then they did some truly crazy things, and God reacted surprisingly reserved. We were talking about this in a study the other night. Because God does a plague. He takes out like 3% of the population. We did the math. 3% of the population, that's more than any one single disaster has ever done in human history that we have recorded, meaning that we don't know what it's like for a population to lose 3% of itself. But what he did to Egypt, to that same generation of Egyptians, you kill all the firstborns. All you have to do is figure out, well, what was the average family size in Egypt? And then you know what percentage. What is it? If they were four, then it's a quarter of the population. If it was a sixth, it's a sixth of the population. Not to mention how many people died in the hail and all the kind of stuff that had happened before. Like, what God did to Egypt, especially ending with killing the firstborns, you know what he says right before that all goes down? Right before the firstborns die, when Egypt's going to lose between a quarter and a seventh, if we're being super generous, of their population all at once, just smashing the records for anything that's ever happened all at once in human history. He says, Israel is my firstborn. You know who Israel's referring to? He's referring to Jacob. Jacob, the one who wanted to steal the firstborn, who wanted to steal the birthright. Jacob, who wanted to be somebody. Right before he kills his enemies and judges the gods, as he says, he judges Egypt's gods, he says that Israel is my firstborn. And he means the people at that point, but they're synonymous, the way that it's used. Calling Israel, referring to Israel as a person, because they are the fruit of Jacob. This is what it says. If you have a Bible or if you have a device that contains a Bible of some kind, turn to Hebrews 12. We're going to read like 23 verses, and so you might want to follow along that way, and there are no notes for it. Otherwise, yeah, you're out of luck. So, here's what it says about firstborns in the New Testament. Chapter 12, verse 1. Therefore, we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us, looking unto Jesus, the author and finisher of our faith, who for the joy that was set before him endured the cross, despising the shame, and has sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. For consider Jesus, who endured such hostility from sinners against himself, lest you become weary and discouraged in your souls. You have not yet resisted to bloodshed, striving against sin, and you have forgotten the exhortation which speaks to you as to sons. Mainly, my son, do not despise the chastening of the Lord, nor be discouraged when you are rebuked by him. For whom the Lord loves, he chastens, and scourges every son whom he receives. See, if you endure chastening, God deals with you as if with sons. For what son is there whom a father does not chasten? But if you are without chastening, of which all have become partakers, then you are illegitimate and not sons. Furthermore, we have had human fathers, of course, who corrected us, and we paid them respect. Shall we not much more readily be in subjection to the Father of spirits and live? For they indeed, for a few days, chastened us as it seemed best to them, them being our earthly fathers. But he, our heavenly Father, for our profit, that we may be partakers of his holiness. Now, no chastening seems to be joyful for the present, but painful. Nevertheless, afterward it yields the peaceable fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Therefore, strengthen the hands which hang down and the feeble knees, and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be dislocated, but rather be healed. Pursue peace with all people and holiness, without which no one will see the Lord, looking carefully lest anyone fall short of the grace of God, unless any root of bitterness springing up cause trouble. And by this, many become defiled. Lest there be any fornicator or profane person, like Esau. For who for one morsel of food sold his birthright? For you know that afterward, when he wanted to inherit the blessing, he was rejected. For he found no place for repentance, though he sought it diligently with tears. For you have not come to the mountain meaning Mount Sinai, that may be touched and that burned with fire into blackness and darkness and tempest, and the sound of a trumpet and the voice of words, so that those who heard it begged that the word should not be spoken to them anymore. For, as an aside, they cannot endure what was commanded, and if so, quotes, and if so much as a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned or shot with an arrow. And so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I am exceedingly afraid and trembling. Aside over, thank you, Paul. 22. But you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, to an innumerable company of angels, to the general assembly and church of the firstborn, who are registered in heaven, to God, the judge of all, to the spirits of just men made perfect, to Jesus, the mediator of the new covenant, and to the blood of sprinkling that speaks better things than that of Abel. To the church of the firstborn. The way the promise works out is that none of us are the rightful inheritors to this, and yet we, the church, are the firstborn, a church filled with firstborn, filled with people who are glorified. The point that God surely is making through the thematic use of, hey, firstborns are important, except none of them will be firstborns in the line. None of the important people, all of the people in the lineage of Abraham, the patriarchs, the people we look to, the people in the hall of faith in Hebrews, all of them were losers. All of them were non-rightful heirs. And yet they did. Why? Because as he says about Judah, he overcame his brothers. So what does that mean then if we are the firstborn? What is the, where do we go? Well, then the question is, well, what was it with the firstborn in the Old Testament? How did God deal with the firstborn in the Old Testament? What was the practical implications for them? Well, in Exodus, this is what happens when God is explaining why the firstborn are going to be given to him. You see, there's a rule in the Old Testament where in for Israel, all the firstborn of the cattle, the sheep, all the animals, all the firstborn males were given to him. They are mine, said God. Like, no negotiation. They are mine. They are mine whether you give them to me or not. And all the firstborn men, the people, the humans, they are mine. And the idea is that you would sacrifice the firstborn of the animals. So then what do you do with your firstborn son? He's mine, says God, but you'll redeem him. And that's kind of left, when you get this in Exodus, it's kind of just like left like that until you get an explanation for it in Numbers. So we'll read Exodus first real quick, Exodus 19. And Moses went up to God, and the Lord called to him from the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob and tell the children of Israel, you have seen what I did to the Egyptians and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now, therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, then you shall be a special treasure to me above all people, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words which you'll speak to the children of Israel. No mention of the firstborns in there. The entire idea behind that is the whole purpose of Israel. And we miss this because they never became it. The whole purpose of Israel was that they were going to be a nation of priests. A nation of priests. And they were never a nation of priests. What happened was is that during this, when this is happening, the people are starting to question God, even though they've just seen all of this freedom that they've been given from Egypt. They've seen all the miracles, all the plagues, everything that they saw. And then when Moses goes up, as you all know, he comes back down, and then there's a calf. They built a calf. And at that point, what Moses says to do, it blows my mind, he says, anybody who's on my side stand, he draws a line. This is where, line in the sand. This is where it comes from. Draws the line. Anybody who's on my side, come. And the Levites come. And the Levites stand on the other side of the line, and he says, today you go and you kill your brothers, and you kill your fathers, and you kill your, you go and kill the people, go. And they kill, like, I don't know, 14, 18, some thousand? It's a large number. It's a large number. The Levites go and they do this, which is crazy, but the blessing that was given to them is that, okay, from now on you will be my special people. You will be the special people, right? The Levites will. That was their reward for loyalty, for taking God seriously. And then you're like, okay, right, Levites are special people. But here's what this means. We know that they were supposed to be a nation of priests, but it turns out that only the Levites became the priests. Here's how that transaction goes down. This is the last thing that we'll read. This is Numbers 3. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, now behold, I myself have taken the Levites, from among the children of Israel instead of every firstborn who opens the womb among the children of Israel. Therefore, the Levites shall be mine because all the firstborn are mine. On the day that I struck all the firstborn in the land of Egypt, I sanctified to myself all the firstborn in Israel, both man and beast, they shall be mine. I am the Lord. He changed the firstborn of Israel into Levites. He took the Levites instead. There's a point later on in Numbers where they're presenting the Levites as a sacrifice. They stand them up and they're like, the Levites shall be a wave offering and a heave offering for you, right? And you get that if you've gone through the tediousness of figuring out all the sacrifices that they have to do. But either way, it's the idea that they were an actual sacrifice. They weren't going to be killed, not like that kind of stuff. It's that instead of taking your, the plan was that God was going to take the firstborn male of every person in Israel and they were going to serve as a priest. That would be the honor. And instead, because they didn't want the honor, like Esau, he took the Levites. And he accounts this to the person. He has them count all the Levite males, count all the male, all the firstborn in the rest of Israel. And if there's any difference, if there are more firstborn in Israel than there are, you have to pay a certain amount. The Israel has to pay a certain amount of money to account for the Levites because this is supposed to be a one-to-one Levite count to firstborn count in Israel. So if the Levites were the firstborn, and we are the church, the firstborn, it means that we are the Levites. It means that God's plan in the new covenant, as a better covenant than the old covenant, is that we are living out the idea of what he wanted, which is a people of priests. The implication of being the firstborn is that, and here's the funny part, when they divided up land later on in Numbers, all these different tribes, they divided by lots, blah, 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 the Levites inherited no land. What they were to inherit instead was God would be their inheritance. You see, the difference when you're trying to explain to people what heaven is, and you should never try because it's a disaster. It's like gold streets, sounds hot. How am I supposed to value something that's paved? Like, I don't value asphalt, but I bet you I would value it if it was really rare. Like, how does that all work, God, right? And then you kind of get the picture at some point when you really, you take it. I think what really happens with most Christians, just guessing, is that I think you start liking God a lot more and you're like the heaven part has to kind of catch up, not the other way around. I don't think you look at heaven or like, that sounds fantastic. I should get into this God thing. I've never been excited about going to heaven. I've been excited about meeting God. I've been excited about being done with pain. Done with sorrow, that the person who protects me here protects me full-time there, that my purpose is over. My purpose is being an example of Jesus, toiling and following the footsteps of my ancestors, and Paul and Peter and the apostles, that all of that, the difficulty that comes with that, the sadness that comes with that, that all of that's gone, that's what I want. Streets of gold. And I don't mean to belittle it. Maybe that's important to some of you guys. Don't know why. Maybe it is. But I think that's the difference, because I don't think that Esau saw gold and riches in the promise. I think he saw this benign, arbitrary promise from the God he hadn't met. So why would that be attractive to him? Why wouldn't soup be better? At least soup is tangible. So it comes down to this. If the promise is tangible to you, then all of this is very attractive of being the firstborn. It's kind of like the Levites either lost or won big. Lost big, won big, depending on what you want. If what you wanted was an inheritance in land and that kind of honor, then you lose by being the Levites. It's like we were rewarded with literally nothing. But if what you wanted was God, the reward was far more honorable, far more great, far more fantastic than anything that anybody else got. The point is this, if you feel in your life with your purpose that your purpose is unknown or meaningless, you have to know that God replaced other people with you. And that should carry meaning. It means that you're somebody. And if you are somebody to God, if you are something to be glorified to God, then why would you fear anything? Why would you think that he wouldn't be with you, that he wouldn't take care of you, that He would treat you like a firstborn, and the firstborn theme runs through both covenants, through the Old and New Testament. It's all over the place, meaning he's appealing to something that we should understand. And if we understand what that is, it means that the firstborn was raised up above all others. And we are that. That's wonderful.